This week on Reality Check, as part of our continuing series on climate change, we are pleased to have Alan Drenet and Kathy Conway, facilitators of SOCAN, which stands for Southern Oregon Climate Action Now, a group of over 1,400 folks committed to working on climate change. And we'll be talking about the current political situation regarding climate change, both locally and nationally. That's this week on Reality Check. And hi, folks. This is Lee Tooley, your host, and welcome to Alan and Kathy.
Thanks so much for inviting us.
Thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today. Very busy guy over there in the Rogue Valley, and you folks have taken the time to come over and do this presentation tonight, which by the time this is heard will be in the past tense. But I know you wanted to start by talking a little bit about the history of climate change, understanding how it evolved from long ago, actually. It's not a new thing at all.
Well, I think that's exactly right. That's the message that I'd like to start with. Very often when people are talking about global warming, climate change, they think it was something invented by Al Gore 10,
right,
15 years ago. And the point I would like to start with is saying there's nothing new under the sun. In fact, the first murmurs about this whole issue came to us back in the early years of the 1800s, 1820. Joseph Fourier, a French chemist, was the first one to start suggesting that maybe there's something happening in terms of the way the atmosphere retains heat that's radiating out from the surface of the Earth. And then in the 1850s, John Tyndall started putting this together a bit more. And by 1896, the first person to actually, to my knowledge, who actually identified the problem as being generated by the Industrial Revolution, which happened in the 1750s, was Svante Arrhenius, who is a Swedish chemist. And he's the first person to say, well, you know, we're increasing the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that is a global warming gas, and that is liable to cause severe problems down the line. And, of course, back in 1896, he was projecting it was quite a long way into the future. And we'll come back to Svante Arrhenius in a few minutes. And then by 1988, a lot of folks have done research in the interim nearly 100 years, and Jim Hansen, who was at that point executive director of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies with NASA, went to Congress, and he presented to Congress, I think this was to a committee that was actually chaired by Al Gore, but I'm not sure, and he explained to Congress what was happening as we were beginning to understand more and more about the increasing concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and what this was doing to climate. And I haven't talked to Jim Hansen, but I would guess in his mind he said, well, I understand the science. I have gone to Congress. I have explained it to them. And I would bet after that he said, well, they'll fix it.
Right.
Now, look how well that turned out.
Yeah.
And as we go through the next few decades, we come to Bill McKibben, who's an author and the, I think he was the originator of, and students from Middlebury College, which is where he was teaching. They initiated a group called 350.org, and Bill McKibben was writing, and still does write, a lot about global warming, climate change. And he wrote a book called Do the Math.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, what he was doing was explaining to people the math of global warming and the degrees that this global warming, the greenhouse gases, the impact this was going to have on the planet. And he was making the point that we need collectively to divest from fossil fuels and reduce our use of fossil fuels if we want to protect the planet. And then anybody living down in this area, which isn't far from where Kathy and I live, of course, is familiar with what's been happening over the last few years. We've had wildfires, the famous Chetco wildfire from 2017, for example, and back in 2018 again, we've had more wildfires. We've been watching droughts happening. We've been looking at river flows during the summer and fall that are dwindling, and we know what the impact of that is on our anadromous fish, our salmon. they don't like those conditions. Then last year, the National Climate Assessment Report came out, which really underlined exactly what's happening across the country and made the point very clear that global warming and its climate change consequences are not something that's going to happen way in the future to people way over there. It's happening here and it's happening now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yes, wake up. Reality check. Wildfires, dwindling snowpack, reducing river flow. It's happening now.
And we're losing our fisheries, for instance, our crab fisheries, gone by the wayside pretty much, and continues to deteriorate.
And that's true. And then the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, again in 2018, released a report in which they were assessing what it was we need to do to prevent, if you like, global catastrophe. Mm-hmm. And the point that they made was we absolutely must limit our emissions of greenhouse gases and the concentration of these gases in the atmosphere to a point where we do not go above 1.5 degrees warmer than the temperature was pre-industrially. And the point that the IPCC was making was if we don't do that, we are seriously in danger of devastating the life support system that's our planet.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't take this problem seriously, what we are doing is sacrificing our children and our grandchildren for our own short-term benefit.
Let me just stop you there for a second, because even since those reports have come out, I keep hearing these devastating announcements about how this is accelerating much faster than they thought, and that's accelerating much faster than they thought. And the number I've heard lately is 12 years before we're kind of fried and done, if we could just go on the way we are. Can you, I know it's impossible to predict given all the variables involved, but is that kind of how you see it, or would you tweak that one way or the other?
Well, and I just mentioned we have to be 45% below the 2010 emissions by 2030, and that is the 12 years that you just mentioned. And I think the evidence is very clear that unless we take this seriously and do something seriously about it, we are in grave danger. My background is in biology, and what really pulled me into this arena was a period when I was teaching ecology, and I was teaching a segment in the ecology course about how what it is that determines the distribution of our natural systems, or biomes, as the biologists call them. And all I mean by biome is coniferous forest, deciduous forest, desert, grassland.
An ecological system, in other
words. Yeah, ecological systems.
Yeah.
And it turns out the two variables that determine where these various biomes exist on the planet are temperature and water availability, i.e. precipitation rainfall. And as I was teaching this, and this was back in the late 80s, I was realizing that if we follow the trajectory that was being projected at that point of global warming, what we were going to do was to destroy the climatic conditions that support those biomes across the planet. And that's going to be devastating for all of the biodiversity that those natural systems support. And then I realized, duh, well, if that's what's going to happen to our natural systems, what's going to happen to our agricultural systems, forestry systems, and fisheries? Mm-hmm. Because they are controlled by exactly the same variables.
Oh, sure.
And what we're going to do is not just devastate those natural systems and the biodiversity, but we're also going to destroy our own capacity to produce food and fiber and fish. And so when that revelation, if you like, had occurred to me,
mm-hmm.
I decided I better spend some time trying to understand the climate science as it was understood then to decide whether that was credible. Because if that was credible, it's alarming. And I will say since then, my understanding has grown. I have total confidence in the climate science. It, to me, is totally credible. And when people say to me, as you have heard them say to people who are climate activists, which is what I've become in retirement, they say, well, you people are just alarmists. And my response to that is, if you understood the science, you would be alarmed as well.
Well, that's why I wanted to ask you that, because I often hear it couched in terms of our children and our children's children. It sounds to me like this is not way off in the future.
Exactly.
This is like 12 years is a blink of the eye. Most of us are still going to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't been until just recently that we've realized how quickly things are happening.
Exactly.
And some of the modeling suggested we had more time, mm-hmm. but now things are happening so fast that we realize we don't.
And it's a gradual decline, right? I mean, it's not like in 12 years somebody's going to pull a switch and we're all going to die.
That's right.
But life is getting even now more difficult. I mean, I can't tell you how many clients I'm in real estate in my retirement career. I have three different clients from the Paradise Fire and mm-hmm. a couple more from mm-hmm. the Santa Rosa Fire. I mean, when you look at the reports, they talk about this will happen in the Northeast and this will happen in the Southwest and this will happen, you know, and they leave out the Northwest because we're really blessed in a lot of ways. But we're getting all those other people that don't have any place to live anymore. And it's happening. It's already happening.
Yes, it's absolutely true, and you alluded to this problem a moment ago, that things, and Kathy did as well, things are going faster than we expected. Again, one of the criticisms that we so often hear from those who would prefer not to accept, they don't like the reality check, is that those global models, those climate models, are so exaggerated in terms of the projections that they give us about what's happening. And yet, when we look at the models, what we find, and compare the models to what's actually happened, we've been doing this for long enough now, we can test our models and say, well, the models suggested this, what actually happened? And when we do that, what we find is, time and time again, what's actually happened is either way worse than the models projected, or at least at the worst end of the range.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we look at the models, and there are different models, then they're based on the kind of assumptions that you make. Projecting into the future with climate models is the same as any other modeling. What you do is feed information into the model and see what it tells you, given those assumptions. And it turns out that what we think of as the worst case scenario for our future is actually what's called the business as usual model, meaning we just keep doing what we have been doing. Ever-accelerating use of fossil fuels, accelerating emissions of greenhouse gases, and that's the trajectory we're on, the worst-case scenario. Again, anybody who looks at this and doesn't say that's alarming, I would have to say is just not paying attention.
Yeah, I know. And it's, you know, I think for some people it's a little overwhelming because it's science and a lot of big words involved and things like that that make most of us kind of bored.
And if I do that, stop me and say, wait a minute.
Well, absolutely. It's a challenge, I think, to always be translating those things into
yes.
everyday understanding. But, you know, it is something that is affecting us here. It's affecting our fisheries,
mm-hmm.
affecting our forest and our wildlife. It's affecting the natural beauty around here. It mm-hmm. hasn't made a big dent yet. But if you go back in the hills, there's a dent going on. And the watersheds, and on it goes.
You're exactly right, and that's the issue. That's the reality check. Pay attention to what's going on. And what we're finding is so many times people will look at what's going on, like the wildfire problem that we've been facing, and they will say, oh, that's the tree huggers, that's the environmentalist, it's the northern spotted owl. And they're not looking at global warming and realizing that a prime driver for what's been happening in terms of wildfires, and you probably talked about this in a previous program, is global warming. It's not the only contributor.
Right.
It just makes things worse. And unless we address that problem, I will submit that it's almost irrelevant what else we do, because we're simply not going to address the problem. When we have increasing temperature, drier summers, what we're getting are dry vegetation, dry soils, conditions perfect for wildfires. Doesn't necessarily increase the number of times fires are initiated, but when they start under those conditions, they just take off. And so what we're getting is incredibly large wildfires in terms of area burned, and global warming is a primary driver to that.
And aside from the human crisis it causes in whatever neighborhood gets burned out next. You know, there's these huge economic impacts that people don't, I don't think, always appreciate.
Yes.
That, you know, all our big cities, for the most part, not all of them, I mean, still Chicago, but most of our big cities are on the ocean front, mm-hmm. and they're going to be going underwater. Miami's already going
yes.
underwater. And the economic dislocation of all these folks and the jobs they used to have,
mm-hmm.
all of that's going away. And, you know, on the other hand, we have to afford to pay for the damage of fires and these kinds of
yes.
catastrophes, hurricanes, and so forth. So, you know, I think when I look at the economic impact, it's really quite scary.
Well, of course, one of the counter arguments that we constantly get when we're talking about solutions to the problem of global warming and its climate consequences is how much is that going to cost me?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to pretend that every solution that is developed is a total win-win solution,
right.
But many of them are. But my response to that is, well, if you think it's going to cost you a few dollars to address global warming, what do you think the cost is going to be if we have no agriculture, no forest, and no fisheries? What's the cost of that? Well, the answer is extinction.
Exactly.
Most likely. How much are you prepared to pay to avoid extinction?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And again, it sounds alarming,
yeah.
but reality check.
Well, the economic impacts are going to affect everybody. I mean, the mm-hmm. whole national economy is going to be under severe stress as these things
yeah.
advance. And it makes it harder to respond in a creative, effective way if we don't have the money to do it with. So there's that, too.
Oh, absolutely. And the longer we put it off, the more expensive it's probably going to be to address the problem.
Right.
Let's do it now. Let's do it 10 years ago.
I wish yeah. we could turn the clock
time
back.
Machine.
Yeah, right.
But also, as people like businesses are looking at the cost of, mm-hmm. say, the impact of the fires this last year, they're looking at what they can do. I think of it as a Band-Aid, putting a Band-Aid on what's happening.
Right.
And they're not thinking climate change is driving this. In addition to those Band-Aids, we need to treat the cause. And that's one thing we're trying to do, is get people to think about the climate change and what we can do to reduce the things we have going that are impacting on
and
climate change.
It's a lot of short-term thinking rather
yes.
than long-term
yes.
thinking, which humans, we seem to have this mm-hmm. problem with long-term thinking. We're mm-hmm. always going for what's the immediate gratification, or turn it the other way around, the symptom relief.
Yes.
Rather than getting after what's really going on, because, as you say, it's building up a momentum that's going to be hard to turn. Already is hard to turn, but it's going to get worse.
It is. But we have to do it. And
yeah.
I'll give you an analogy, which is very personal. Back in 1995, I was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia, and I was given absent treatment 2 months to live. And the oncologist who was talking me through this, he knew I was a scientist, so he tended to do it in graphs and charts.
Right.
And he pointed out, if I could get into remission and then go through 4 rounds of chemotherapy and total body irradiation and a bone marrow transplant, my chances of being alive in 2 years would go from 20% up to 50%. Now, when somebody says to you, your chance of being alive if you do this is 50% in 2 years, that gets your attention,
right?
But you say, wow, that's awful. But then when you compare that to dead in 2 months, it starts to look a lot better. And so Kathy and I were going through this experience together, of course, and we made this decision. Well, all we've got to do is be in that 20% and that 30% and that 40% and that 50%. And that's exactly where we are with this whole global warming issue. We cannot guarantee that we can solve the problem. But we know if we do nothing, where it's going to end up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the other thing that plays into this, if we start talking about the politics and economics of it, is that, you know, we've got the Green New Deal out there and mm-hmm. so on. And there's so much opportunity. You know, there haven't been any startups in America in quite a while now. It's like very strange. Startup process seems to be kind of stalled out. And yet when we look at climate change, there are so many opportunities for entrepreneurs to create something new, to make some serious money doing new things, to provide more jobs. It's really, you know, the direction that we could be going in. And people talk about, well, how much is it going to cost? But how much can it make us as we lose these old industries that no longer are viable, that we have a whole new industry just waiting to be tapped into?
Well, and in the economic arena, one of the points that's really worth making is, and doesn't matter where you go, if you ask the question, where is the employment now when it comes to energy? The answer is it's in renewable energy. That's where all the jobs are. And anybody, as a certain individual does, who's arguing we need to resuscitate the coal mining industry, is living in a dream world. That energy source is no longer a viable, provides a survival future. It doesn't have many jobs. Renewables have way more employment than the entire fossil fuel industry combined. That's the wave of the future.
I think I heard somewhere that the fastest growing job producing segment is renewables and related
There's
job
no doubt
categories.
About that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's not cling to the past because it's destructive. Let's go with the future. And the point that's very well worth making is that we're not arguing against technology. What we're saying is, let's use our understanding of technology, let's use it judiciously and focus on the technology that's beneficial, not harmful.
I think, too, you know, as a lead-up to your presentation, we've run several different shows on climate change, and I went back just before, in fact, I think it's playing now, we went back to our first show, which was done back 6 months or so ago, and it had Ed Patterson and Deborah Wirth on, and had a great conversation. But listening to it again, because we reran it, we thought it's a good introductory, but it was so dark. It was so dark. And I feel the contrast between then and now, at least in my experience of what's happening out there politically. We've got the Green New Deal, and every new candidate that's running, at least on the Democratic side, is at least mentioning climate change in their coming speeches. Some people are even basing their platforms on it. That is a huge sea change from it being verboten to even talk about it.
And certainly from 2016, that's a tremendous change in political interest, which is wonderful. And you mentioned the Green New Deal. There is a bill that's being that has been introduced federally called the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, and that's encouraging. It has a little bipartisan support. I think there is one Republican who's part of the introducing group, and then we have the possibility. You mentioned the Green New Deal, and we have the House Bill 2020, which has been introduced into the Oregon legislature, which really makes a great stab at taking care of this problem in Oregon, of getting Oregon to become a national leader when it comes to addressing greenhouse gas emissions.
What does it provide for?
Well, it's the program that it's going to develop is, it's called the Oregon Climate Action Program. It's based on bills that have been introduced in 2017, 2018 called Clean Energy Jobs Bills. So it's essentially the same thing, and it's what's called a cap, trade, and invest bill, which essentially the basic premise of the bill is in Oregon we're going to cap the emissions of greenhouse gases from the major emitters of that pollution, and then we're going to ratchet that cap down over the next few years to meet certain interim and ultimate goals. And folks who are major polluters have to obtain allowances to pollute. And the basic premise is the allowances, which are based, each allowance is 1 ton of carbon dioxide equivalent emissions. The emitters have to buy those at auction. And so what you can imagine is as the cap goes down and down and down, the competition for those allowances is
right.
going to go up, so the price rises, so the incentive to polluters to figure out a different way to do business than emit greenhouse gases is going to get more and more profound. And so that's going to encourage them to switch to non-polluting renewable energy sources and non-polluting techniques.
So where is this bill right now in the process? This is not something that we get to vote on. It's something the legislature will be voting on. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's been introduced into the legislature. It is a House bill, and I don't know whether there's going to be a parallel Senate bill introduced, but it's going to have to work its way through both chambers. We've been working on this now for many years. In fact, the first legislation that was passed in Oregon was in 2007, when Oregon was really seriously a national leader. And that was a program that established limits to greenhouse gas emissions in the state of Oregon. And the trajectory was to become 75% lower than 1990 emissions levels by 2050. This House Bill 2020 is just a bit more stringent than that. This asks for 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. It's still not quite as strict and stringent as we need, because by 2050 we actually need to be net zero emissions. But the bill says at least 80% mm-hmm. below. So it's better.
Does that have like interim steps? Because
yes.
Start talking 2050, I'm not even going to be here. I mean, I can hardly wrap my mind around, you know, 5 years from now, let alone 50.
It does 20. Have a 2035 goal, which is 45%
yeah.
below 1990 yeah. level by 2035.
Yeah.
Again, not quite the 45% below 2010 levels by 2030, but at least better
yeah.
than the 2007
yeah.
bill. And the key thing is that 2007 bill mm-hmm. passed by the legislature, signed into law by Ted Kulongoski, was a purely voluntary bill.
Uh-huh.
There were no teeth, and the consequence is we are absolutely not on a trajectory to achieve those reasonable goals.
I was going to ask you about that, because you said we were the leaders, as though that's past tense.
Oh, that's past tense, yes.
Oh.
Now, California's ahead of us because they have a cap trade program in place, and they are seeing their emissions go down.
Hmm.
And California's economy has not tanked.
No.
In fact, there was a study that was just released. It was put out by a group at Berkeley, a group of economists in Berkeley. They looked at the 2020 bill, mm-hmm. and they said, this is going to lead to an expansion in the Oregon economy. And when we look at states that have enacted some kind of a greenhouse gas emissions cap,
mm-hmm.
every one of those has exhibited greater economic growth than the surrounding states.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, and again and again and again, we get people throwing their hands up and say, you're going to tank the economy.
Right.
Gas prices are going to shoot up. Look at California. When the California bill came into effect, which was really not until about 2012, gas prices went down. Now, that's not to say that the cap and trade bill in California is the reason that gas prices went down. What that demonstrates is gas prices are under a wide array of control factors, and what kind of a fee is being imposed on the pollution is just one of them.
Uh-huh.
And in California, other factors were much more profoundly affecting gas prices than that bill. And we get the same thing with utility prices, natural gas, electricity prices.
Yeah.
They say the prices are going to shoot up. It's not what happens when these kind of programs are enacted.
Well, you know, it's pretty interesting when you think about the renewables that are calling upon resources that are free, basically, like sunlight,
mm-hmm.
wave action, and things like that. I mean, getting it to market is the challenge. But,
right.
You know, ultimately, as these systems become more efficient, you would think they would be in much better shape in the long run.
Well, absolutely. When we look at the historical patterns, what we find is there's a measure that's really valuable when it comes to energy, and it's called energy returned on energy invested.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense.
Right.
The question you're asking is, how much energy do I have to expend to get this unit of energy in my fossil fuel or my gas tank or whatever?
Yeah.
And what we find is, with fossil fuels, the energy you return on the energy you invest is going down, whereas with renewables, it's going up. So where's the future?
Yeah.
It's in renewables.
Exactly.
It's not in fossil fuel.
So
Reality check.
So talking about this 2020 bill, House Bill 2020,
mm-hmm.
What else does it say in practical terms?
Okay, well, we started off with the cap, which reduces what is allowed to be emitted in the state of Oregon. But the other components to that are the trade and invest components. The trade part of it is very simply that if a corporation buys its allowances and finds itself unable to confine its emissions to the allowances that it bought, and there's another corporation that it turns out is incredibly effective at reducing its emissions, and so it has allowances left over.
Right.
That corporation can then sell its unused allowances to the one that has not managed to reduce its emissions. So
that's a
trading of allowances.
Isn't it?
Yeah, so if you're smart and you
ahead of the game.
Yeah, ahead
right.
of the game, then you have extra allowances and you're not just sitting there with them. You can actually trade them, and it's to your advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other company has to put out the extra money.
Yeah, so it's going to really encourage innovation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And being forward
exactly.
thinking about it. That's great.
So that's the trade component. And the invest component is something where this is what would put Oregon ahead of becoming a really serious national leader. The invest component is one that is really important in my judgment, and that what that says is that the funds that we generate from the sale of these auctions, these allowances to pollute, those funds are going to be used to serve society in the following ways. The most obvious is in promoting energy efficiency and promoting renewable energy, promoting the research and development in those areas. But also, one thing that we really are aware of is there are some components of society who are more compromised by climate change than others and will be more potentially more compromised by the transition in our energy economy.
So we're talking about like the people in Miami that are going underwater, that kind of thing?
Well, that could be part of it.
Except they're not in Oregon, but yeah
right.
That
but,
idea.
What I was thinking was people in rural economies.
Uh-huh. So if we lose our fisheries, for instance, because of the warming of the sea here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, coastal communities could be eligible for this. So those kinds of social inequities.
Mm-hmm.
So for people who have financial challenges,
mm-hmm.
the money that comes in then can be used to help them as prices might increase to pay for their expenses. So that's a community that has a challenge that is going to be hurt more
mm-hmm.
by the changes and this legislation than has the resources to help them.
Gotcha. Right.
And rural communities tend to be in that group, and so there's a big focus in the bill on rural communities and the areas we live in fit in their definition mm-hmm. of rural.
Well, that's great news for Brookings.
Yes.
Absolutely, yeah. And so that's the invest component.
But also on the invest, there's money for things that sequester carbon, that take carbon out of the atmosphere. And so there's some forestry practices that can be used, and there would be money then to support the development of those techniques. There's a new area, it's been called regenerative agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So the way we grow our crops, investing money in that so people who might be interested but don't have the finances, they could be a recipient of some of the funds, and then it would support things that help us all.
So would that be like no-till gardening kinds mm-hmm. of practices?
Yeah, that exactly. fits within okay. it. A lot of our organic gardening practices and even more things, but we know now they can make a big difference. But we got to get people to do it, so they oftentimes need a financial boost to mm-hmm. to just get those things going, and the bill would, through the invest part, would have money then to help them, which would help all of us.
And that kind of brings us around to the whole idea of self-sufficiency too, mm-hmm, which is yeah. something a lot of people around here really care about, and, mm-hmm. and getting more self-sufficient as far as our food supply is concerned, things of that nature. We don't have to be hauling in. And it's kind of a circle, because now we're not having to haul in as much food and other kinds of products and use all the gas for transportation
Absolutely.
Of products.
Right.
Yeah. yeah.
There's this word sustainability, which really fits in with that concept of mm-hmm. Of security. And those are the kinds of behaviors that are promoted. One of the problems that Kathy was alluding to in agriculture is we have succumbed to this industrial agriculture model.
We sure have.
And it's the oil model. Mm-hmm. So we invest in fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides. And all of what that does, this incredibly tilling the soil, what it does is take the organic matter out of the soil, break it down, and put it in the atmosphere as mm-hmm. carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
And the regenerative agriculture that Kathy was talking about is a suite of agricultural behaviors that are designed to pull that carbon dioxide back out of the atmosphere and put it back in the soil. And we know that that we're in such a serious condition because of the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that we absolutely need to do more than just reduce emissions. We actually have to get some of that stuff out of the atmosphere, back into the soil, back into the trees. And this bill, HB 2020, provides funds to support the kinds of management techniques that do that. And that's why, if we pass this, we will be ahead. We will be a national leader.
So if we want to support that bill, people listening feel like, oh, that sounds pretty good. What do I do? You know, because you write your local congressman, that sort of thing.
Yes, the bill is a state bill, so contacting your congressman, your federal congressman is not going to help with HB 2020 because it's a state bill. Yes, contact your local representatives. In the case of Curry County, it's House District 1, mm-hmm. David Brocksmith. Mm-hmm. And your senator is Dallas Hurd, contact them and urge them to support the bill, to look at the bill, identify, find out from the bill what it does to help rural Southwest Oregon, and support it. And if there are aspects of the bill that you would like to improve, do that.
Mm-hmm.
But we absolutely need to do something, because down here in Curry County, folks are suffering because of global warming, and we all need to do our part to solve the problem. You asked a question earlier about what other states are.
I'm
going to go back to
that,
because Kathy made a note down here. Answer that one. So the major player in this arena is California, but also there's a set of 10 states out east that are engaged in what's called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, otherwise known as REGGIE. And what they have done is combined to adopt a cap and trade program,
mm-hmm.
applying it to their utilities.
Mm-hmm.
And what that has done is reduce the carbon dioxide emissions from their utilities. So it's been effective. And again, what they have shown is economic growth, whereas the surrounding states have not.
That's very exciting. I mean, a whole region of 10 states, that's a pretty big chunk of the country, really.
And two provinces in Canada are signing in with California, Quebec, or Quebec, as folks down here probably call it. I live there, so it's Quebec.
Quebec, and
and Ontario adjoining with California, linking. And one of the things that we're hoping Oregon can do is link with the California program, because that's going to make administration so much more cost effective.
You know, it really looks like there's a big trend to just act locally, you know, think globally. When the federal government is not that open to things as historically it has not been, you know, we find people and states and smaller entities like cities getting off the bandwagon. I know the town of Sebastopol, and there's other towns like that that have just taken on the challenge in a big way. I think Sebastopol has already exceeded their goals of getting energy independent and so forth.
And you're exactly right. One of the arguments that we have been making in connection with House Bill 2020 is the federal government has simply abdicated any acceptance, and this is coming out of the White House and the Republican-controlled Senate, and it was the Republican-controlled House, of course, and they've been calling the science a hoax, so they have not been doing anything. And what that has done is placed increased onus and responsibility on states and smaller jurisdictions, as you were just describing it, to take up the slack and do something. And that's again why, in our judgment, getting Oregon to pass this House bill is so important. And we're lucky we have a governor who's on board, and we have a House Speaker, Tina Kotek, who's on board, and a president of the Senate, Peter Courtney, who are on board. So we got the leadership on board. We are probably in pretty good shape in terms of the membership in our House and our Senate for passing the bill. But what we really, really need are to get this to be more bipartisan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all live on the same planet.
Right.
Climate science is not a partisan issue.
No, it certainly isn't.
We got to address it.
I saw the other day there was a poll recently taken about folks that felt it was an important issue. I forget exactly how the question was posed. Something like, "Do you feel this is, you know, a really important issue coming up in our immediate future?" That kind of thing. And 80-some percent of Democrats thought it was. 35%. Approximately, might give or take a percentage point here or there, of Republicans thought it was, which is really different from what it was just a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like, you know, the information is finally getting through to people, and it sounds like a small number, but it's way up from what it was.
Well, and I think it's not only the information, but we're seeing the consequences.
Yeah.
And for a scientific person, understanding the numbers can convince you there's an issue. Our problem. But for people who don't have a science background, they need to see that something's going on. And when we get the smoke from the wildfires, we can see it. And mm-hmm. and so people are starting to understand, like you said earlier, this is not my grandkids. This is me now.
Right.
And we need to do something. And so as we look at the legislation, you know, things are going to be passed in Oregon, in the House and Senate. But the power that we have as the people is really strong, and I think everybody should realize that writing a letter, making a phone call, talking to neighbors about things like the House Bill 2020 is really something important to do. So one thing we've done is we've created on our website a page where we update what's happening with the bill and ideas on what people can do. And if I can share that website,
oh, yeah,
I can.
Please.
So it's SOCAN, SOCAN.info, and then /CEJ, that's for Clean Energy Jobs.
And could you spell out info?
Okay, so SOCAN, SOCAN.info, INFO, /CEJ for Clean Energy Jobs. So as the bill moves along, then we'll track that so people know. We'll put ideas on what might go into letters to the papers or letters to elected officials. It's good to have city councils say that this is something they value, and then send that information to the state team that's working on this. But we all have a part on this, and if we care about making a difference, Oregon really has a big chance to have a strong voice.
Let's be sure and give that website out at the end of the show, too, so people have a chance to grab some paper. So speaking of, about SoCan and your efforts to get this going, can you say a little bit more about SoCan? You've got 1,400 members, and we now have Coastal SoCan, our little group here in Brookings that's affiliated.
We're very excited about that, I want you to say.
We're pretty excited, too, actually.
Good.
Yeah.
So SoCan
started out of our concern about what was happening with climate change, and it's developed over the last six, seven years. We don't have officially members, but we have people who are part of the group that participate at different levels. Our mission is to educate and to encourage action. Mm-hmm. Because the education is important as a base, but it's not enough. We've got to take action, and as we're seeing now, we've got to take action now. That's the name. So we have different projects we do. We do presentations. We have it's called Master Climate Protector. People come for 10 weeks, three hours once a week.
We just started that last night.
And so they learn about different aspects of climate change, and the idea is that they're more educated and they can talk to people then. And we have service hours that they do if they're interested. We have monthly meetings, different topics. Those are in Medford. And so we're hoping to get the Coastal SoCan group to help support them and doing some meetings so that the broader public can be more informed and be encouraged to take action.
Well, that sounds really great. And you've got a lot of different educational outreach. I don't really know that much about it, but on the website, I think you've got some different things listed that people can look into.
Well, Kathy and I come from a background in education, both of us. So not surprisingly, as co-facilitators of the organization, that's something that we encourage particularly, and it was right there in our mission, promote understanding and awareness. Mm-hmm. And yes, we feel it's very important to educate not just people, but particularly kids. Mm-hmm. And what we're discovering, the Green New Deal that we mentioned tangentially earlier is a good example. But young folks are realizing more and more that it is their planet, and they have got to get involved and understand the issue. And that's one of the reasons why we make ourselves available for to teachers to help them incorporate discussions of the science into their classroom in the way that it's right for their curriculum and their instruction.
But if you're a listener out here in Brookings and can't go to Medford every week for a class, are there resources that they can connect with on the website that, you know, point them in some directions that they can deepen their understanding?
We try to put links of information, and we try to organize it in a way that it's manageable. So if people want more information, we're hoping it's on the website. But there's always a... on the bottom right-hand side of the front page, there's a place where you can send an email if you're looking for something and it's not clear, and we're glad to help you find it. Or we also use that to know what we need to do to improve the website. But we try to make sure that everything we do is science-based, and so we try to put in the sources of the information where people can go. So there are things from what I can do as an individual, what I can do with others, but then also information on what recent developments are. So we try to include it all on the basic website, which is SoCan.info. That's our main website.
SoCan.eco.
I'm sorry. SoCan.eco.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah, I'm sorry. A while ago, we were an info, and a new URL came up to be an eco group. So let me clarify that.
Okay.
Our main website is SoCan.eco.
E-C-O.
ECO, so SOCAN.ECO. And then if people want information about the bill, the House Bill 2020, that's SOCAN.ECO/CEJ for clean energy jobs. So we need to correct that in the information we give out.
Okay, so
another feature on the website, and this is something that we promote whenever we're doing presentations, is we have an informational sort of hotline. So if anybody has a question about climate science, or now in the connection with the legislative proposal, if they send an email to climatequestions@socan.info, mm-hmm. now that is an info because that's our mail,
right?
Then we will answer it.
Well, that's great.
As best we can.
Yeah.
Well, and we set that up initially for teachers who might not have a broad understanding of what was happening, but wanted to do some things in their classroom. So as a support, if they had parents or students who were asking them questions that they didn't know the answers to, they could just send an email to us at climatequestions@socan.info, and we would get back to them.
That sounds good. So we're also just getting this Coastal SoCan off the ground mm-hmm. now, and you know, it's a little unclear exactly what we'll be able to offer in the future. We've been talking a lot about outreach to the school, as you were just describing, and also having perhaps a monthly or bi-monthly presentation, this being the first one that you're going to be doing tonight, and other kinds of things going up on. We've got a class going on right now led by Bill Gorham, which is called Change is Our Choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been part of that group, but it's been really quite interesting and certainly a great way. It's only 5 sessions for a person to get their feet wet, and it's very interactive, so
yes.
It's a very little reading, but a lot of hyperlinks to videos and things of that nature that are really easy to take, and then great discussions when we do meet together. And I know Bill is interested in offering that class again in the future, and I'd like to just make a little plug here for that, and that's Bill Gorham, and you can reach him, that's G-O-R-H-A-M at gorham.bill@gmail.com if you'd be interested in that class. And also, if you're interested in Coastal SoCan in general, we have Ed Patterson has been leading that group and asking to be the contact person for that, and his email is edlinpat@gmail.com. So those are some options for local stuff. If you've got any input you'd like to put in terms of what you're seeing Coastal SoCan taking
shape. Well, one of the points that I was going to make is by the time this is broadcast, there's a real possibility that we'll have a Coastal SoCan page on our website at socan.eco.
That'd be great.
Because that's something that we are going to be talking with them about today. They can, your listeners can probably find that group by coming to us.
And I'd like to stress how important it is to talk to other people, be part of a group. You talked about how dark this can be, mm-hmm. and it can be really depressing. And if we stop there and just kind of shut down, it doesn't do any of us any good.
The antidote to depression is action.
That's right.
And so working with others to take action is just really, really important. So I really encourage people to be part of a group, and it can be informally, it can be email, but just to interact with others about action, because there's so many things we can do, and we need to help each other do them.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that individuals can do around their home, that
Indeed.
Kind of thing, that add to their self-sufficiency and ability to take care of themselves while taking care of the planet. They're not necessarily onerous, difficult things to do, but it makes a difference. And it's that old saying, if we each carry a bucket.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's a case of thinking it. That one of the points that I often make when I'm doing presentations is we used to, when we were kids, we used to spend our time worrying about dollars in and dollars out. And if dollars in exceeded dollars out, everything was rosy and we were happy. And what we have now come to realize is, in addition to our little money account, we need to start thinking about our energy account, and particularly our greenhouse gas emissions account, and factor that into our daily living, and think about what we can do to reduce our emissions just on a daily basis. And it doesn't require going back to the Stone Age.
No.
It just requires a little judicious thought about mm-hmm. how we behave.
Yeah.
And we can help one another. And it's great to, and one of the things that we find folks who come to our meetings well saying is, it's really just so nice to spend time with some like-minded individuals.
Oh, for sure,
It's very rewarding.
And working together on these kind of projects where it's appropriate to have a group working on something, you know, it just increases the viability of our community, the sense of community that each person shares. And it can be really meaningful and satisfying to be part of that kind of work together.
Totally.
Yeah. So we're just about to wrap up here. We've got just a minute or two to go. Any last thoughts that you'd like to share? Anything we've missed talking about?
Well, could I go back to something we have talked about?
Yeah.
And the really, really, if folks are concerned about intergenerational justice, about leaving for their kids a planet that's inhabitable.
Yes.
Please, please get involved in this issue and support House Bill 2020. I know that the emissions from Oregon are small on a national or global basis.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that in order to protect our little corner of paradise, we have to ask other jurisdictions, other states, other nations to help us out by reducing their emissions. But if we don't take the lead, we have no credibility and no moral authority to go to other states, other nations, and ask them to do anything. Because the first question they're going to say is, so what are you doing?
Exactly.
And if our answer is, well, we've decided we don't need to do anything, ha, where's that going to end up? If we care about future generations, then it's incumbent upon us to pause and ask the real question, what can I do to help solve this problem?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think we've, if you're any kind of student of history, you know how we've mobilized, for instance, in World War II to meet a challenge.
Yes.
And I think we're all still quite capable of doing that kind of thing again. I don't think it has to be this overwhelming thing that, you know, we can't do anything about. People are very, very capable of marshaling their personal resources and community resources
Absolutely.
And making a change that makes a difference. So I want to thank Kathy Conway and Alan Jarnay for being on. We really appreciate your participation. And I want to thank everybody for listening. This has been Lee Tooley, your host, with Pi White, co-producer and technical support. And it's been Reality Check on KCIW, your community radio station.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.